Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Paul. It's nice to be back at OC Talk Radio after a bit of holiday in Hawaii. And although I returned on Monday, and this is Thursday, I think, or is it Friday? Oh, this is Friday. And I am still, believe it or not, this is weird, but I'm still experiencing jet lag from Hawaii. How do you experience jet lag from Hawaii? I don't know. Maybe it's just my excuse to be lazy. I'm not sure. But anyway, today I am I'm very interested in our topic, and we are with our good friend Terry Hershey, and I would like to talk about his most recent post in Sabbath Moment titled, See with Our Heart. Only I want to expand the topic a bit to include how a soft heart can open a window to your soul. And we will explain what a window to your soul is. There are just moments in life where you get to see deep inside of yourself that is consciously blocked off, because seeing inside of ourselves is sometimes a scary place, sometimes a pleasant place, but often a scary place, and it requires a soft heart to get there. And so I want to include that. Throughout my life, I have discovered every now and again moments that I call windows to my soul. And typically, as I stated, these occur for me when my heart is softened or even broken. Weddings, for instance, are joyful moments that soften my heart and allow me to see past my conscious self and grant me this entrance into something we're going to talk about, thin places that separate our conscious and unconscious selves, or even into our soul. However, I've also found my windows to my soul most often occur in tragic moments of my life, generally in times of serious loss. But let's see what Terry has to say on this. Yo, Hirsch, que pasa?
Charles, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, no one knows you're fluent in Spanish. You could have answered in Spanish with a long Spanish thing that no one knows except our Spanish listeners.
Mi amigo.
Okay. Well, I got the mi amigo. I appreciate that.
I just said, what do you want today?
What do I want today?
Yeah. In other words, if there's a phone call, it's usually somebody that wants something.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Isn't that? But that's not always true with me. You know, I call you to see what's up. You know, I call you for the podcast, but try to keep that at a minimum because I always love our podcast with you. I just wanted you to know that I was deeply moved by Seeing with Your Heart. It was a most meaningful post to me. Thank you for that. That was very insightful, and I would encourage people to listen to it.
You can tell them how I started it. I started by admitting that I cry on airplanes.
I know. I do, too. I used to when I don't watch movies on airplanes anymore, it seems, except on the 21-hour. I find myself watching maybe two movies on the 21-hour, but I end up doing a lot of work on my computer or reading. It's a good opportunity to read. Now, as we get into this subject, I wanted to start it by saying, I think you know, I myself fall into agreement with the Stoic philosophers of old, like Seneca the Younger and Marcus Aurelius, ones that argue for the vital place of reason as a guiding light of our life. And I think there's a lot to be said for the way they appropriate reason. And it's not just a head only. It involves the entirety of your life. But it also seems to me that neglected from that is the most impactful moments we find their origin from my heart, not my head. My head and my heart are both essential, but each function in a vastly different and unique ways. Terry, what are your thoughts on the sort of the differing functions of the head and the heart? I know that's a really broad reach question.
Well, yeah, I know you. I know you. Like those guys, as you should. And I think, well, now more than ever too, because of the way we're bombarded with data, it's helpful to have a cranium that can process data. You know, a mind that can think reasonably, and stack those two things together. And so I think I see the cerebral part of me is able to put together puzzles easily together. And so that I need that capacity to do that, to see clearly for the puzzle pieces, in order to navigate whatever it is, whether it's something I need to experience in life, et cetera. However, the heart enables me to either savor the puzzle or enjoy the puzzle or grieve the puzzle. You know, and I say puzzle only because life is really about pieces anyway. We don't really know what's about to happen, so the pieces kind of come together or don't come together. And so our mind can sort of do that, but then we need to let our heart take ownership of that moment. Here's the differentiation for me, because I was raised, as you know, very, very conservative, fundamentalist, religious. And you can relate to this part, because for them, it's cerebral only, in the sense that it's, I mean, we talk about giving our heart to Jesus, I said that, but they didn't really ask you about your heart. What they asked you was, what do you believe? In other words, tell me where your head is. Tell me what your creed is. In other words, name it. I want you to name it, say it, and defend it. Now you have to defend it. You have to defend the whole thing. And so it's fascinating to me that I was always asked to be able to defend something with a creed, but nobody ever asked me what made me glad to be alive. In other words, so I believe that particular thing, but nobody ever asked me what allowed that to make me experience this day more fully, or allowed me to come to life in this moment. No one ever asked me that.
That's interesting that you would say that. I recall my last year in seminary, I was speaking with a first-year student, and asked him why did he select this particular seminary. And he said, I came here to discover what I believe. And that always, that has never left my mind. You came here to discover what you believe. So you're just going to sit there. It really is a second half faith. You're just going to sit there and let your head get filled up with all of this data. And that is then going to be your belief system. Now, I think as you described, it's easier to describe the head than it is the heart. The head is obviously very logical, very analytical, absorbs data, problem solves. I think that's very important. Problem solving also, great problem solving, really includes the heart. How would you define, especially after your post scene with your heart, how would you explain to us what the heart is? How it helps us make decisions and its role, its particularly unique role as compared to to our heads?
Well, I have an answer to that, but there's a story that I've told many, many times. Harold Kushner was a writer.
The guy who, Why Good Things Happen to Bad People? Yeah. Or Why Bad Things Happen to Good People?
Yeah.
Well, kind of both. It kind of really hits both of those.
Actually, that first one would make a great book. Why Do Good Things Happen to Bad People? but anyway, Harold's son was killed quite young in a tragic way. And people would come to Kushner, and he always wrote about this, and I've used this in my speeches, but, you know, they say, okay, we need, basically they were trying to get him to use his head to, you know, not necessarily to figure out why the death was, but you can now rise above it now, and move past it. Those are the two things. In other words, your mind will help you contain it. See, that's to answer your question. The mind is I want to contain it, right? And in Krishna, in I forget which book, but he says that, he said, but I believed it was supposed to hurt. And he said, in the same way that our
yes.
dead cells, like our hair and fingernails, they feel no pain when they're cut, but living cells bleed and hurt. He said, I believe that spiritually dead souls can be cut into, separated from other souls, and never feel a thing. Never feel a thing. He said, but living, sensitive souls are easily hurt. He said, I don't like being hurt. But when I protect myself against the danger of loss by teaching myself not to care or not to let anyone get close to me, he said, what I lose is a part of my soul. He said, if we believe that in order for life to be good or contained or understand it or we avoid pain or all that stuff, you know, where it makes sense and it's nice and neat, he said, the danger is we'll be so good at not feeling anything, including pain. We will not feel joy or love or hope or awe. In other words, we'll be emotionally anesthetized. To answer your question is, my heart means I'm not emotionally anesthetized. It means the part of Terry that allows all of those things, like tenderness and gentleness and empathy and grieving and anything having to do with connection and love, that's alive and well. Your heart tells you that's alive and well. And there are so many ways that we want to either bury that or cover that or make it, you know, just like we were as boys growing up, quit crying, girl. Don't big boys do that, right?
That's right.
There's just elements that is, we know that's secondary.
Oh yeah, and I'm
true.
And I'm with you at I call them hokey movies, hokey airplane movies. I need tissues. I'm always even though it's a dumb movie, there's something about it that gets me, you know, that tugs at the emotional side of me.
Well, I think what happened is that inadvertently, that's why pets are so marvelous at that. Inadvertently, you know, a hokey movie or a pet or something that happens that pulls at the part of our heart that we have covered up with something. And so what I want to do with the heart is I want to let it be the one that sees this moment. And maybe the behavior that there's a, do you remember, you know, Morris West, the novelist, Morris West?
I'm sorry, I don't.
His my favorite book of his was called The Shoes of the Fisherman.
I think you had me read that. I think you did have me read that.
Yeah, sure I did. It was about an archbishop. It's a novel, but it's about an archbishop who was served as a political prisoner in Siberia. And then after that, he was sent to Rome. And anyway, in the end, he becomes Pope. Guy used to be a prisoner. So it's like a Mandela story, anyway, in a sense. Anyway, in the book, when he's making a decision to his Pope, to many of the other archbishops say, he's got too much sort of self-doubt and other stuff that's going on in his life. Why can't he just be more forthright? And so there's one that says, the two advisors, what does His Holiness have to say? And he says, he has such a soft heart, and I think it's going to be too soft for the good of the church. The other one said, well, you know what? He's actually lived life and suffered more than we have, so maybe he has the right to trust his heart. I love that. And so what we do, instead of dismissing moments when the heart is, what? How do I touch what is at the depths, at my core, just like Carol Clincher says, what is at the core of who I am? How do I touch that? And when I touch that, and I'm accessible to that, and so we do ourselves a disservice when we assume that when we touch that, it's always having to do with what we would call our emotions. And our heart's not simply just about emotions, although there's an emotional response to all of it. But just like the crying at a movie, of course, that's the emotional part. However, the capacity to receive something about the softness of whatever went on, whether it was a relational thing or a kindness or generosity or a gift or rising above, or all of the little things that make us more profoundly human and profoundly alive.
you know, I've been studying, I hate to use the word religion because not religion, but I've been studying that a bit. And I have discovered that so much of the text in the Bible would be so much better read through the heart than it would be through the head. And it is so often read through the head and therefore is distilled to laws and regulations and rules. And if you follow this, then you're going to get to wherever you're going to get, whatever you're going to do. However, last week on the podcast, you remember Tim Timmons?
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, I had Timmons on the podcast last week, and he's part of this controversial film that just came out on Netflix called The Family, and they are into you put the words, it's Jesus plus nothing. It's reading the Gospels, and as I going by sort of the old what would Jesus do, you know, how would Jesus? That's the primary focus. And I tell you, I read the Gospel of John again, and it is, I don't understand how you can really read that with the head and not with the heart. That is a very heart focused, a very heart focused book. Oh, we got a little distraction here for a minute. I think there is a place for the head and the heart to work in harmony. And many times I find myself, and I'm sure listeners agree, that I would find myself making decisions and somebody would ask me why. And I was forced to respond to, I'm not able to give you this really logical answer, but there's something inside me that says this is the right decision. And it's going with gut. That's sort of seen with the heart, is it not?
Sort of. I mean, yeah, sort of. I mean, because going with the gut, I mean, it's a different kind of response in one way. But it's just because that's an intuitive sort of thing. That's my intuition tells me that. In other words, I'm making a reading.
Yeah, yeah.
What
Go ahead.
What I will say to you is that very often when I am making a reading, it's underneath what my cerebral sort of stacking it all together is. My cerebral things, I have a list. Here's a why I should and why I shouldn't list. That's my cerebral thing. And so my gut is something, there's something underneath all of that. And so I would say that it can be reinforced by the heart. There's no doubt about it. Or it can reinforce things of the heart. There's no doubt about it. But for example, I'm gonna go with my gut with a decision about a person who works for me, and I'm gonna give them a chance to do this, even though the list tells me, my mind tells me, that's probably not a quote good decision to make. However, I'm gonna go with my gut here, and one of the reasons I'm gonna go with my gut is because I have a connection with this person. And there's the soil, and this is now the gardener in me comes out, there's the soil of my heart that allows me to make that decision, that enables me to trust something that my list tells me maybe might not be a good idea, or enables me to put energy into someone personally that I might not have done before, etc. So yeah, the heart can fuel that. But the heart is the full capacity of who I am as a human.
Well, that's you know I think you're leading me into a question that I wanted to offer to you, and that you're making me think that the heart, I have been thinking the heart and intuition are synonyms, and but that's not really true. You're right. Those are two very different points. But what I think the heart can lead into, and this is where I want to kind of change our direction just a little bit, and that the heart is what gives us access to the depths of our soul, to who we are really. I don't see the head as being the entry point for that.
Correct.
Now, I want to talk about windows of the soul and how they occur and what they occur, because I think they're really important. And I find you don't have many of those. I probably have had fewer than 10, probably much fewer than 10 in my entire life, that I get this view of a reality of who I am that goes into my unconscious. And you quote the Celtic writer Marcus Borg, and he writes about thin places that separate separate the conscious from the unconscious, or the head from the most hidden parts of the soul. And I would like you to talk about those thin places, because I like that phrase a real lot, that there's a difference between the heart and the soul, or the head and the soul, but there are thin places, and sometimes we can pass through and sometimes we can't. Talk to me about thin places.
Well, much of my life is predicated on defending myself against something. And so as a child, I don't have many, a really young child, you know, you're not defending yourself. So you have unmitigated joy, and you have unmitigated sorrow, and you have, you know, everything's unmitigated because it's just there. It's out there. And then I'm told, you know, you have to sort of rein it in, because sometimes you have to, quote, grow up and be an adult. And a lot of that is reining it in and sort of, so I can be either more well-behaved or act more reasonably or rationally or any of those kind of things. Or, you know, religious, act more Christian, you know.
Right.
And there's all these ways that end up reining all that in. And so I did, and so when I, the more I defend myself, the less I am available to thin places. Illustration. Right now, near Bashan, in this part of the Puget Sound, you know what an orca whale looks like, right? Have you ever seen an orca whale in the wild?
I believe I have. I do they go to Hawaii?
No. Orcas no, don't go there.
No, then I've not no, then I've no. not seen them, except maybe no, in Dana
see,
Point
yeah,
or something.
See, see, Charlie, orcas are more like normal people. They can't afford to go to places like Hawaii. You hang out with the rich whales. See, the rich whales
are the humpbacks.
The humpbacks
are the rich whales.
The gray whales and the blue whales. Yeah, you go with the yeah. The orcas, they go up the coast most of the time.
Oh, then I guess I haven't seen an orca. Take that.
That's why, because if you had, you would have actually stopped the conversation to tell me about it.
Oh.
That's because the two pods are here. There's two pods. We know their names because they're an endangered species now, and at least they're being watched. So the orcas, as they're commuting through here, we call it commuting. I mean, they're on their way to their migration, but, and so the people stop what they're doing to go down to watch the whales. Because when one comes out of the water, you literally, you get giddy. Everything, and I'm talking about a thin place now. Whatever, that little child in you wakes up. And the first statement is, life is good, life is awesome, this is what life should be. And you make yourself available to things like awe and astonishment and grace and wonder. And it's incredibly, and you do yourself a disservice. And if you stop and either try to figure out or name it right away. Of course, we do the next thing. We take out our phone and take a picture of it, because, you know, you can't experience it unless you take a picture of it.
Do you know how many pictures I took? I was only there for 10 days, but how many pictures I took in Hawaii?
Good, none.
Zero. Not one single photo. I've been to Hawaii before, and I couldn't see pictures of resorts.
Yeah, you would love this, because you're a concert goer. You've been to many, many, many concerts. And And, you have a appreciation of certain artists, you'll go to them several times. And as you have done, there's a true story about a person whose friend, they left their phone in the car, so they're in the concert, and he's freaked out. He says, "How can I enjoy my concert without my phone?"
I have often thought about that, about going into a restaurant or some place and realize that I left my phone in my car, and I'm suddenly have this panic attack that, well, I need my phone. I said, what the hell for? What, you know, I don't need to be right. talking to anybody. I don't need to, I have, you know, unless I'm by myself, I have guests that I need to pay attention to. I have friends that I need to pay attention to.
Attention is a good way to talk about thin places, because what the thin place does, it allows you to pay attention. That's like when you walk into a cathedral. I say that because of just this last year when I went into Notre Dame. You know, you walk in and you just all of a sudden you slow down a minute and you're quiet. And something wakes up.
Now, please go ahead.
Well, it's the same for me when I walk into certain gardens. That's a cathedral for me, but it's also a thin place. But the thing about the thin place is many times it takes you by surprise. And that's what's powerful about it.
Now, you know, we've spoken about the thin places and the moving into, you know, I'm not sure if that's moving into the unconscious or not, but it's moving into a different place in our conscious sort of scheduled, tactful reality, that we're moving into a place of softness. And it's, you know, you could call it soft heart since I'm such an advocate of the conscious and the unconscious, that it takes us to a place that reminds us of who we are and what our DNA is all about and what gives us joy and also what brings us sorrow. And I want to take a little bit of move. I know Paul likes us to take a break. So this would be a perfect time for our break, and then we can conclude. Hi there, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and I'm on with my good friend, Terry Hershey. I think I can say our good friend. He's been on the show so many times and always offers such great insight. And today we're talking about soft hearts and to the thin places and perhaps even to the unconscious, how they lead us to realities about ourselves that are not often accessed by the conscious world. Paul asked a great question in the midst of the break, and it's taking the place of where I wanted to go, but we'll get it. Terry, how do you keep a soft heart in today's world in the United States when it is so controversial and there's so many frustrating things that hit the logical, analytical side, but they do also impact the poor, the disenfranchised. How do you keep your soft heart in the midst of that without letting it take over, letting the head and anger side take over?
That's a great question. You know, the funny thing is, I mentioned pets. I just threw that in there a while back, but that's why those, you know, all the time we spend on social media, but even the social media gets overrun and overcome by people shouting at each other.
Oh my goodness. Yes. I don't even read it.
Still, still one of the number one kind of Facebook posts is a cute video of a cat or a dog. And, you know, it's like an emergency stop just to exhale. Because we have to remind ourselves of that. The answer to the question is you have to do something kind today. I read a book recently called Love Your Enemies. It was just written by Arthur Brooks. It's a political thing because he's talking about the fact that how is it possible? And what was really helpful is the number one, and this is just John Gottman. I know I'm throwing a lot of names around, but John Gottman is famous. He and his wife, and her name, of course, escapes me, but famous for work they do with couples. Do you know the number one thing that will determine, and they can know, they sit a couple in a room and have them talk about something that the couple has, that has unnerved the couple, and they can tell within 10 minutes, and they can give a 90% accuracy whether that marriage will make it, based on one thing. Do you know what it is?
No.
Whether the couple has contempt. If you have contempt for someone, you're doomed.
So is that an unwillingness to forgive?
No, it's an unwillingness that you actually dismiss. You're dismissing that person completely. You don't.
Okay. So there is forgiveness.
But my point is, to the question about how we stay soft is, in all the battering, I end up, and I see people around us, we have contempt for ourselves. In other words, we've dismissed our very selves. We've dismissed the child within us.
That's, in other words, do you think that is more common? Do you think age has anything to do with that? About as we grow up and we learn more, we experience more, that in the beginning we may be, except for those, you know, in the Myers-Briggs that are Fs, you know, we experience life more through the lens of the head than of the heart. And as we grow older, if we grow older, as they say, gracefully, or if we grow older in genuine maturity, that we see the light, see our lives with our hearts more. Do you think that's possible?
I do, actually.
I'm going to do something really different here. There's a guy named Derek Sivers. It's S-I-V-E-R-S, not Silvers. And he writes blogs every now and then. And I want to get to this third portion, but I'll read the first couple of portions quickly. He says, cross the world four times. In your 20s, take it all in. Get involved. Stay up night talking with people. Strangers everywhere, kiss and fall and promise them all, make a lot of mistakes. You cross the world the first time to fall in love, the second time in your 30s to tell everybody what you've learned. You're full of answers since you've done so much, and you have known the kind of changes and mistakes and see clearly the path you change. You cross the world the second time to make change. Now, this is the one I really like. The third time in your 50s, you cross the world to compensate. You realize what a blowhard you were in your 30s and how little you actually know. You've been humbled. It's time to make up for years of thinking wrong. Pay close attention and listen without judgment for once. Have no answers, only good answers and good ears. Crossing the world the third time is to unlearn. I love that.
Fabulous. And I love the fact that the humility is a part of that, because When you are connected to your heart, that gives you the capacity for humility. And so to answer Paul's question, see what he's describing is a paradigm shift in the way you frame things. And if I'm involved in the rage and hatred that poison our world and all the stuff that, and if I do that, see that only with my head, then I ask different kind of questions, you know, just like you said, the kind of questions he asked the first time around the world, et cetera. And so how do I stay soft? I tell people, like, for example, instead of asking you, I can tell you, but we can talk the news. And we did that before we went on the air. I can talk about the news and I can talk about what you think or believe, et cetera. And I can get pissed off and you can get pissed off, et cetera. Or I can say, well, what'd you accomplish? In other words, I can ask you all the questions with the paradigm of my head.
which are very easy to deal with.
Correct. Or easy to be mad about, one of the two. Or I can start, and I'll get to those, but why don't I, the Paul's question, how do I stay soft? I start with a different paradigm of questions. I say, before I do anything, tell me today what made you smile real big.
Well, you know, I try to do that in our conversations. If you notice, I try to make the first subject of our conversation your garden. Tell me about your garden.
Exactly.
Today.
Exactly.
And I know you're going to go to the heart of things right away.
Exactly.
And
it's interesting when I have a conversation with people and you start with that, they're like, excuse me? What?
Unless we're both intentional about it. I want to go. We have just a few minutes left because you have an appointment in 12 minutes.
I do.
And
right.
I want to go to a whole different direction, Terry. And I want to talk about the thin places and the windows to the soul. And windows to the soul, we've been talking about the pleasant rewards of those thin places and how we can access moments of our childhood and access moments of glee and joy and contentment. But windows to the soul doesn't always mean that. And at this time, you know, as I talk about seeing through windows of the heart, or through the eyes of the heart, I want to talk about windows to the soul. And personally, I find that windows to the soul and the heart to be a most dangerous playground to dally in. It sometimes requires a level of vulnerability that is not ordinarily a fun place to be. I'm not talking about the kind of vulnerability that has to do with other people. Actually, I'm talking quite the opposite. It's about admitting an often but not so pleasant truth to me about myself, that in
right.
this window to the soul, I'm able to see my shortcomings or faults, or it's really not a pleasant thing. Have you ever found an opportunity like that where you're not, it's not a guilt trip, and it's not that at all. It's about seeing yourself, you know, the you in your own skin in a different light, that you don't have to live that out, but that is a part of who you are. Do you find any truth to that?
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole thing about therapy, if it's good for you and you're good at it, or journaling or anything, when you look in the mirror and you realize our capacity for cruelty. I'm talking personally now, my capacity for cruelty and or stupidity. And I don't mean that as a moral price tag, but my point is that I do things that are the antithesis of what is either my better angel or in creating environments for the better angels of anyone around me. And those kind of places can sink me either into deep despair and or depression, which I have wrestled with in my life, or they can take me to a place where I just lash out at whoever's around me because of my anger. And I assumed always younger that this was something I could beat. You know, I could rein it in. I could fix it. And one of the greatest questions my therapist ever said to me is, are you willing to be loved for being this you? Not the together you, not the one who gets past all this. Are you willing to be loved for being this you?
I'm sort of silent right now because I find that to be a profound question.
And if you're willing to be loved for being this you, okay, now we're somewhere. And so, in other words, he changed the paradigm from, if I look at this me, I can, and I put a moral price tag on it, I can be chagrined or disgusted or embarrassed or shamed or any of those things. But he said, I don't know why you're going there. First of all, that child needs to be embraced. You see that child? That's one hurting child.
You know, I had
child even know what it's like to be embraced.
I had an experience that, you know, I have a myriad of psychological disorders, not a myriad, but two or three that impact me severely. And I decided to one time to experiment with not taking medication. Said, I'm just going to go off medication. And I titrated down and I went off. And after about 3 weeks, I was sicker than I've ever been in my life. I mean, including flus, any kind of illness. And it was a mental illness to where that window to the soul opened to the ugliest places of my life. And I was able to see what a jerk I've been in certain times and certain places. And it was very, very painful. Yet at the end of that, Terry, as I came out of that, and I remember calling my doctor, my MD, and told him that, I didn't call my psychiatrist, I called my MD, and told him, you know, I think I've got something wrong with my blood. I've got a blood disease, and because I'm just totally dysfunctional and really way out. And he asked me about situations, and I told him, oh, yeah, I quit taking my meds. And he said, help me understand. You were feeling perfect on your meds. You decided not to take them anymore. And now you're feeling like crap. And I said, yeah. And he says, well, take your freaking meds and call me when you're better. You know, it's just that was simply it. But nevertheless, it was during that time I learned through the dark side of me, through the different sides of me, I learned so much about me and how it helped me to be a better person. It helped me to understand the faux pas of my life and helped me to understand how I can be less judgmental, I can be more open, I can be more kind, more empathetic, more considerate. So I just want to encourage, if you go to those windows of the soul and you find not attractive things, there is a place for them that helps you if you're a life learner, that helps you to discover different ways to live your life. Have you ever experienced anything like that?
The different ways to experience life, you mean?
Yeah, different, you know, seeing the uglier part of yourself that has made you a better person today.
Because I'm not, the whole thing with his question is, are you willing to be loved for being this you? Means I'm not afraid to look at it.
That's a great way to put it. I'm not afraid to look at it. Because we bury it so far that we don't want to see it.
I don't need to pretend I'm not that person. I don't need to deny it. See, that it gives me the capacity to apologize. It gives me the capacity to be forgiven and to forgive. It gives me a remarkable capacity.
Boy, we're going to end this part of the podcast with that right there, because I think that's a wonderful thing. Now, before we close, I think this is an important time of your life, and I want to talk about a new book that you have coming out October 14th, 2019, titled This Is the Life. I know you've been working for a couple of years on this project. You want to tell us about it?
This Is the Life. It's about mindfulness, basically, living in the present moment. In other words, doing away with if only and when. It can boil it down to one little sentence. A little boy says to his mama, 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 listen to me, but this time with your eyes.
Yeah.
In other words, be here. And so what are the ways that I'm not? So, I'm October the 14th.
Now, do you show ways how you can implement mindfulness and live a life in the present?
Yeah, there are tools. There are tools and ways to do it.
That's great, because I find it so hard.
But what people don't understand is it's not a program. It's not like there's a checklist of am I doing it correctly.
No, that's not you. You are not a checklist guy.
But the paradigm thing I gave about questions. There you go. There's a mindfulness thing. Before you ask what you accomplished today, ask what made you smile. When you do that, you're in the present. You're mindful.
That's wonderful. I look forward to the books. You're such a fine writer, and where will people be able to get this book? Amazon?
Amazon, of course. Yeah, Amazon, of course. Or just terryhershey.com. Okay. And it's an audio book, and then you can get it for the people that read it on their devices too, whatever that's called.
Okay. Well, I encourage on their devices. Yes, there you go. There goes your what self is that called? That's called your
caveman.
Not caveman, yeah. But Luddite self.
Yeah, bye, man. I'm jumping on the next meeting.
Okay, Terry. Thanks so much for being with me today. Love having
you.
All right,
man. See
you. Okay.
Bye.
I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.